Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
And away we go. This is hour two. So if you are thinking about getting on the air, call now because the show will be over before you know it. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Lily in Chicago. Good morning, Lily.
Good morning. Hi. Good morning, Patrick.
Hi.
I'm calling in for your opinion. My husband and I do not have children, but with the grace of God, we are adopting a sibling pair from Colombia, a 9-year-old boy and a 7-year-old girl. Now, the 9-year-old boy has been diagnosed with an intellectual disability, either of mild or moderate degree. We're still not sure because we still do not have the results of his last neuropsychological testing, and we still do not have his full case file. But because he has special learning needs and will likely need support services due to his intellectual disability, I'm being told that the Chicago Public School System would be the best setting for him because they will have these services available for him, including speech, occupational therapy, and whatnot. But my husband and I want to give these children a really good Catholic education, and I'm currently considering homeschooling through the Colby Academy. Or another option is enrolling them in a Catholic school. But the thing is that with the Catholic school, I'm afraid they might not provide all the support services that he will need. And then with the homeschooling option, I'm not sure if I would be depriving him of any important services he will need. So I'm not sure what you think would be the best option for them.
Okay. This question actually did come up, I think, about a week ago, if I'm not mistaken. And I was happy to find out that the Archdiocese of Chicago, as is true for dioceses in general, in their Catholic school system, they do have those kinds of programs available for special needs children. So especially in Archdiocese the size of Chicago, which is maybe the biggest, if not second biggest, maybe third biggest, but it's right up there. So the easiest way to find out is contact the Archdiocese and ask to speak to that department for the Catholic school system and inquire. And they will be able to tell you, and they'll give you whatever resources are available. They will be able to tell you specifically what they are so that you can evaluate that option. So that'd be how I would handle that. Now, if you choose to go the homeschooling route, then I would inquire with the state and the county to find out to what extent can homeschool students avail themselves of those resources. Now, I know that that's done in the area of sports pretty commonly nowadays. If you have a child who's homeschooled, he or she even still can play on the sports teams at the local public school, let's just say in high school. And although it didn't used to be that way, more and more now, that's how it is, I think, everywhere. So that's an example, although it's in sports, but I have a feeling that they have similar resources that would be made available to tax-paying families who are homeschooling their kids. So you should check with the local school district to find out specifically what they have available. That's what I would do.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Patrick. I really appreciate it. And I really want to make the best decision because they're going to be... It's going to be a big life change for both of us, us being new parents, and then they're coming from Colombia to the U.S. They're acquiring the English language and whatnot. So it, So this is we want to make the best decision for them. And then they're not baptized, so I want to ensure that they get right away their catechism. And but it's a lot. But we're being blessed with these two kids, and we're thankful to God. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Well, God bless you, the Happy Holy Family. I hope that everything goes smoothly for all of you. And it's a great thing that you're being so generous this way. Let's go now to Mark in Fullerton, California. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. A couple callers ago, I believe, I want to make sure I get your position correctly, is that okay. If in order to gain salvation, one must obviously, believe that you said faith and repentance and baptism, but also also be a member of the Catholic Church. So this would seem to exclude Protestants. So my question is, if Protestants believe in the Messiah, believe in the resurrection, believe and keep the Ten Commandments, again, the faith, repentance, baptism criteria, they meet that, then what is, in God's view, in your position as a Catholic position, in God's view, what is the distinction that puts Catholics in and Protestants out when they really have, you know, fundamentally the same views and the same faith and the same practice? Maybe not the same practice. That might be a step too far.
Yeah, I understand your question, Mark. And there is so much similarity. We have so much common ground, which is a good thing. But I will recap a couple points I made earlier just for the sake of emphasis. But let's begin with what Jesus himself said. So if we look in Matthew 7, he says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven." So you notice he doesn't say what you believe. I mean, that's part of it. But there's a component of obedience that's present there. Not everyone who says to me, "Lord, Lord," shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, "Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do mighty works in your name?" And he says, "And I will tell them, depart from me, I never knew you, you evildoers." I mean, it's a very strong rebuke. So in context, what we see here is that there are people who profess the name of Jesus. There are people who even do things, perhaps in ministry or preaching or whatever, in the name of Jesus. And they will even be surprised, because he will respond to them by saying, "You are not part of my church." I'm paraphrasing what he says. "Depart from me, I never knew you, you evildoers." What does that mean exactly? Well, I think one very likely meaning of this, and this is the meaning that the Catholic Church sees in this, is that Jesus established the church for salvation, like the Ark of Noah. And with the flood on the way, Noah was told to build this big old ark, and I'm sure it could have held many more people if only they would have gotten on that ark, but they scoffed at him, and they didn't get on the ark, and they all died, except for him, a total of 8 people who survived on the ark. So Jesus established this church. He refers to it as such in several places in Scripture, Matthew 16, 18, and Matthew 18, and we see, as I mentioned earlier, that at the end of his earthly ministry, he's about to ascend to the Father. What does he do? He tells the apostles, "Go into the whole world, bring everybody into this church. Teach them," he says, "to observe all that I have commanded you." Now, this connects, interestingly, with another statement of the Lord. This is in Luke 10:16, where he says to these same apostles, "He who listens to you listens to me. He who rejects you rejects me." That ties in with Matthew chapter 7, verse 21, where he says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven." So what's the will of the Father? Well, he told us, we hear his voice booming from the heavens when on the Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus is transfigured before Peter, James, and John in the presence of Moses and Elijah. And what does the Father say? He says, "This is my beloved Son, listen to him." So the will of the Father, as Jesus refers to it here in Matthew 7:21, is that we should listen to him, and not just listen to him, but obey him. And so this is where that component of action comes in verse 22. Jesus says, you must be baptized. In John chapter 3, to Nicodemus, unless a man is born again of water and the Holy Spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. He ties this in, both in Mark 16 that I quoted earlier, he who believes in him and is baptized will be saved, and also in Matthew 28, go into the whole world, make disciples of all nations, baptizing them. So we're beginning to see in these passages this structure, or this pattern rather, of obedience that Christ is asking of his followers. And some of them are going to freelance, he says, and say, well, wait a minute, we prophesied in your name, Lord, and we cast out demons in your name, and we did mighty works in your name. And his point to them is, you didn't do what I asked you. You didn't obey me. You did your own thing. Okay, whatever. But you didn't do what I asked you to do. And you didn't listen to the apostles, remember in Matthew 28, teach them to observe all that I've commanded you. And he says, as I mentioned in Luke 10:16, whoever listens to you listens to me, whoever rejects you rejects me. So how can somebody say, I refuse to listen to the church, I refuse to listen to the apostles and their successors, and somehow expect that Jesus will say, well, that's okay. You wouldn't listen to them when they said you must be baptized, or that you must receive the Holy Eucharist, or that you must do the, you know, these acts of obedience that Christ is calling us to do. We either take Jesus at his word, where he says, he who listens to you listens to me, he who rejects you rejects me, or we don't. So I don't want to belabor the point, and please forgive me, I'm not trying to pile on or anything like that, Mark, but I just want to give you some of the salient verses so that you can see that the Catholic Church's teaching is not exclusive, or to say that, you know, we're better than anyone else, is that Catholics are in and Protestants, it's not that at all. Everybody is welcome. Everybody has a place at the table. Everybody is invited to attend the banquet of the Lamb, to receive the sacraments, the Holy Eucharist, etc. Not everybody is willing to do it. And so, in essence, the church's teaching can be summarized as Jesus himself said, you know, many are called, but few are chosen. Many people, everybody is invited, but not everybody is willing to come in. And so that's a mystery that's between God and that person. But what we do know is that this is the pattern that Jesus laid down for the church, and he wants the church to tell everybody about it, recognizing that not everybody will accept it. So that's a very nutshell explanation, Mark. Does that, even if you don't agree with me, and maybe you don't, but I mean, does that at least clarify it a bit further?
It does. I just fail to see that a devout, you know, a devout Protestant who listens and obeys, who follows the apostles, follows the Ten Commandments, believes in the Messiah, lives an admirable life. I just don't see how that's a rejection of God and Christ. I don't. I always thought
I can help you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I can help you see it. So Jesus says in Matthew, or in John chapter 6, unless you, first of all, he says, my flesh is real food, my blood is real drink. How can this man give us his flesh to eat? The people say, and they grumble and they complain and they leave him, many of them. And Jesus says, my flesh is real food, my blood is real drink. I am the bread who comes down from heaven. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood will have life within him. And then he says it in the opposite way. If you do not eat my flesh and do not drink my blood, you will not have life within you. That was understood from the word go, from the Last Supper onward, as the Holy Eucharist. The apostles recognized it. The people that they discipled, people like St. Ignatius of Antioch, they understood it. They championed the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. So to use one example here, you talk about Protestants who are obedient to Christ. They're not, at least in that area. And I would say almost certainly they're not doing it out of malice. They're doing it because it was never explained to them. Or the pastor in the pulpit at their church, you know, said, well, that's not what it really means. And so they were misled. They received false teaching. But the point here is that you can't pick and choose and say, well, I'll be obedient on these items, but not on those. I'll listen to the apostles on these things, but not on those things. And that's getting back to Mark chapter 7. You know, you say you can't see it. Well, it's right there in black and white, Matthew chapter 7, verse 21. There will be people, Jesus says, who believe in him, who prophesy in his name, who cast out demons in his name, who do mighty works in his name, and he will say, I never knew you. Now, who those people are, only God knows. It's not for me to know, and I don't judge anybody, but Jesus says there will be people who had faith and they did all these things, but they weren't really obeying him. I'll give you the last word, Mark.
My feeling on that would be people who just put the facade up of being holy and pious, but in their private lives, they don't live faithful lives. That was always my interpretation of that. But for the final question, and not trying to be malicious or divisive, is this the conventional or majority view amongst Catholics? I don't want to.
You mean the rank and file?
Father Simon. Yeah, that only Catholics gain salvation. I mean, obviously it's your opinion, you're expressing it. But is this the conventional view in Catholicism? Because I know a lot of Catholics. I've been around a lot of Catholics, and I've never been told that they're in and I'm out.
Well, no one's going to put it that way. I wouldn't put it that way because you're not out. This is all for you.
Unless we have a change of life or a change of faith.
I think so, yeah. Well, first, let me distinguish between what the rank and file people might say versus what is the church's official teaching. And I think it's a reasonable thing to say that the vast majority of Catholics, they don't know this teaching of the church. They've never been told it, and they have this sort of mushy feeling of like, well, if as long as you're a nice person, as long as you believe in Jesus, then you should be just fine. And that's not at all what the Catholic Church teaches. And what's interesting, Mark, is if you want to read it for yourself, I'd encourage you to read it just so you're aware of, like, specifically what is the Catholic Church saying on this topic. Vatican II, which was the last big council back in the 60s, there's a document called Lumen Gentium. That's the Latin phrase. It means light under the nations. And that's referring to Jesus Christ, who's the light of the world, as the Bible says. Yeah. And in this document, which is a statement about the church and the necessity of the church, there's a section that addresses this very specifically. I can read it to you if you want, but this is the most recent iteration of the Catholic Church's official teaching on this issue. But it's just reflective of what the Catholic Church has always taught.
Okay. So you would think a majority of priests cardinals, bishops, Catholic people like yourself, a majority of them, that is the position, that there is a distinction between the Catholics and Protestants that puts one in and one out for salvation.
Well, no, because that's not the position. If you put it that way, that's not the position. And it's not even a position. It's not like the Catholic Church has a position on this that could change. It's always been this teaching, and that is, it's a doctrine, and it comes from Christ, that he wants everybody in the whole world to be a member of his church. Now, for some, they don't know that. They never realized it. And if it's not their own fault, the Catholic Church says that God, being sovereign, can give grace to whoever he wants. He can give salvation to whoever he wants because he's God. So the church doesn't say, we're in, you're out. It's never put that way because that carries a connotation that the Catholic Church doesn't in any way say. But rather, everybody's invited in, and here is the pattern: faith, repentance, baptism, receiving the sacraments. Now, some people would say, nope, I'm not going to do that. Okay, well, that's what Jesus said to do. And if you don't want to do what Jesus said to do and his appointed apostles and their successors, and they reaffirm that, and if somebody's going to say, nope, not going to do that, well, you know, good luck is about all I can say to that. This is a message that needs to be heard more regularly. And if you yourself want to see it in black and white, officially from the Catholic Church, that document, Lumen Gentium, will give it to you. And specifically, you want to read sections 13 and 14. And to make it easy, Mark, I apologize, I've got to take a break, but to make it easy for you to find it, we'll post that during the break on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid. You can also get it on the show page, which is relevantradio.com/Patrick. Just look on the right-hand side, scroll down a bit, and you'll see it there. And that'll take you right to the section, well, actually to the document. And just scroll down to section 13 and specifically section 14. And that will give you straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Thank you, Mark. Call anytime. I'd love to talk to you again. Thank you. Be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Our sponsor, Christendom College, offers our listeners access to free online classes at getprinciples.com/truth. Acclaimed philosopher Dr. John Cutteback is teaching a class now, Understanding Human Nature, at getprinciples.com/truth.
1, 2, 3, 4.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
All these hijinks we get up to on this program. I like it.
Don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, I do.
Somebody sent me a picture of a gay pride march, parade, whatever, to homosexual, that's how Elton John says it, a gentleman with a child, two children actually, walking in the parade. The child is wearing pride colors, carrying a rainbow flag. And Gary sends this to me saying, I wonder what your response would be to this. Well, what do you think, Gary? I mean, I'm just funning with you. But of course, I don't want to see that. I don't want to see children being co-opted into this kind of scandalous lifestyle. So that's what I think about that. But I just want to acknowledge that you sent me that email. I appreciate that. Steve asks, listening in San Bernardino, California. Good morning, Steve. He says, is it wrong theology for the congregation to pray the St. Michael prayer following the conclusion of Mass? Absolutely not wrong. Keep in mind, Steve, I almost called you Michael. Keep in mind, Steve, that this prayer was composed by the Pope himself. It was Pope Leo. And he composed the prayer. This is, I don't know, 125 years ago, roughly. After he celebrated Mass one morning, he had a vision from God in which he was permitted to see the terrible destruction that the devil, Satan, was going to wreak in the church in the coming century. And he was so so overcome by grief at what he saw God was going to permit. Just like if you read the book of Job, the devil said, hey, I bet I can get Job to turn his back on you, God. Just give me a half a chance, and I bet I could do it. And God said, okay, go for it, try it. God permits these things from time to time. And Pope Leo saw the terrible damage that the devil would do to the church in the coming century, the 20th century for that matter, or in that case. And so he composed the prayer, and he ordered that it should be said at the end of every Mass. Now, just so happens that in the immediate aftermath of Vatican II, when the rubrics for the Mass changed from the old rite to the new rite, that was abolished. It had been prayed at the end of Mass ever since the time of Pope Leo, and then suddenly now it's gone. So is it wrong theology? No, not at all. I would love to see that prayer restored. I mean, boy, do we need the intercession of St. Michael the Archangel, that's for sure. I'd like to see some pope at some point restore that prayer. I think it would be perfect for our day and age. But in any case, once the Mass is over, keep in mind, if somebody says, well, that's not part of the Mass, well, that's exactly right. It's not part of the Mass because the Mass is over. Go, the Mass is ended, the priest says at the very end. And I'm not speaking this at you, Steve. Please don't feel as though I'm grinding on you or anything, because it's not. This is a really good question you're asking. But I have seen people who say, well, that's not part of the Mass. You're not supposed to. It's not part of the Mass. That's the whole point. It's not part of the Mass. This takes place after Mass is over. Immediately after Mass is over, but that's okay. So it's not intended to be an interpolation of anything into the Mass or changing the Mass or changing the rubrics or tampering. It's nothing of the sort. It's a devotion that was practiced for a better part of 100 years. And boy, I think it would be great if it came back. So I'm happy to hear that whatever parish is that you're at, that they're praying the prayer to St. Michael the Archangel. That's great, if you ask me. Let's go to Jim now in Los Angeles. Hi, Jim.
It's Patrick. Question. Good morning. My daughter has a friend. She's Catholic. She wants to marry this young man who's divorced, but he's not Catholic. He was never Catholic. So the parents of the young lady will not go to the wedding because they're Catholic unless he gets an annulment. So my question is, does he need an annulment?
Yes. Yes. See, and here's why. You don't have to be Catholic to need an annulment. So let's take a step back from the Catholic thing for a minute, Jim. Marriage as an institution was established by God himself in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve. And Jesus refers to this in Matthew chapter 19, beginning in verse 1, where he says, they're asking Jesus, well, how come Moses let us divorce our wives? And Jesus says, well, because of the hardness of your heart. But from the beginning, Jesus says, it was not so. Because in the beginning, Jesus says, God created them male and female. And this is why a man leaves his parents and clings to his wife, and the two become one flesh. And what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. So we're seeing here in the words of Jesus, not only the paradigm of marriage, which is one man and one woman, not some other combination. We also see he's using terminology that it conveys the marriage act of clinging to one another and becoming one flesh. We don't have to elaborate too much on that point. I think you get my idea. So he's establishing Jesus is there referring to the establishment of marriage as an institution that precedes all religions. It precedes certainly the Catholic faith, 2,000 years old, that's all, precedes Judaism. And therefore, the Catholic Church, because it believes the teachings of Jesus and seeks to protect people from doing something that would be spiritually harmful to them, it recognizes that as long as the two people, ostensibly at least, are eligible to marry each other, they could be two atheists, they could be a Hindu and a Buddhist, it could be a Buddhist and a Muslim, could be a Muslim and an atheist. It doesn't matter. It could be anybody. But if a man and a woman are eligible to marry each other, and they do get married in front of the justice of the peace or at the beach or whatever, and Catholics are in a separate category, so we're not talking about Catholics per se here, but any human couple, man and woman, the church presumes, all other things being equal, that that marriage is valid. And so an annulment, it has to do with the validity of the marriage. Are these people validly married? And this would be in what's called a natural marriage. It wouldn't be supernatural because, you know, if the parties are not baptized or if one is baptized and the other isn't, then it can't be a sacrament. So it has nothing to do with the sacramentality of the marriage. It has to do with the validity of the marriage. And for that reason, anybody who had a prior marriage, no matter what his background is, even if he's an atheist, he would need to seek a declaration of nullity. And that would be the church's way of saying, this marriage, we found out after due diligence, we discovered that there was some impediment there. There was some obstacle that would have prevented it from being a valid marriage. It was therefore null from the beginning. So yes, indeed, he would need that in order for this girl to be able to marry him. But I wanted to give you the background reasons why so that it would make sense. Does it make sense, Jim?
It makes sense, okay. And then you help out by saying that a Catholic's on a different category, right?
Right. And this is a very good question because it's so often misunderstood. Many people don't realize that the issue is validity. Is this a valid marriage? And in the case of baptized people or Catholics specifically, then there's a separate requirement for Catholics, and that is you have to be married in what's called the church's canonical form. So canon law governs this. And the church's law says that for a Catholic, not for anyone else, but for a Catholic, in order for the marriage to be valid, you have to get married in the Catholic Church. And there must be either a bishop, a priest, or a deacon who's officially witnessing the vows in the exchange of consent and blessing the marriage. And this is under normal circumstances. And if this is not done intentionally and there's no dispensation sought from the bishop, then it's an invalid marriage. But if you, I'm just going to extend my answer if you don't mind. Let's say that you have two atheist friends that said, hey, we're going to go get married to the justice of the peace. And you're wondering, can you go? Absolutely, you can go. Because what they're doing is a good thing. They're getting married. That's a glory to God, even though they don't believe in God. If a Hindu and a Buddhist decide they want to get married, hey, we're getting married at the beach. And the Hindu, you know, priest is going to be there to, can you go to the wedding? Yes, you can go to the wedding. You can celebrate with the couple because they're entering into, by all appearances, a valid marriage. Where it becomes difficult is when there's a Catholic involved and he or she doesn't follow the canonical form. Now, even that, there's a workaround, which is you petition the bishop and ask for a dispensation. Those are very often, well, they're not very often sought, but when they are, they're very often granted. But a lot of people, they don't bother with that. So I hope I'm not over-explaining it, Jim, but does that help a little bit?
Yeah, it does. I was going to ask a follow-up question along the same lines. I don't know if you have time or should I call back later on, but it has along the same lines. You made an interesting point about the dispensation. May I ask it or should I call back
later?
Yeah,
please do. No, go right ahead.
Okay, here's a question. Let's say I have two people that are married. They were both baptized in the Catholic Church, you know, when they were young babies. And then one of the individuals finds out later on that he was a Catholic and he marries, and they're married many years. They have children, whatever. And now he starts practicing his faith, or she starts practicing her faith. Do they have to live like brother and sister if one of them decides, oh, I'm a Protestant, I'm not going to go to church, I don't believe in the Catholic Church?
No.
Does they have to live like brother and sister?
No.
How does that work?
No. Yeah. So once the marriage... Okay, let me phrase it this way, and I want to make sure I understand your scenario. So the two people, both baptized Catholics, they get married as Catholics, and then 10 years later, the husband says, well, I'm no longer going to be a Catholic, I'm going to be a Protestant. Is that the scenario?
No, that's not the scenario. I'm sorry,
okay.
I didn't make myself
okay.
clear. That's
okay.
My fault. Okay, here it is. Here's the scenario. Two people are you know, they're baptizing their babies, okay? So they get married in an unorthodox church. I mean, very unorthodox. This church doesn't believe in the Trinity. It doesn't believe in anything. It's not orthodox. And then later on, one of them says, you know what? I want to start practicing my faith now. That's the scenario. They never got married.
Oh, I see. So one returns I get it. One
right.
returns to the practice.
Right.
Now, when you say they were baptized, were they baptized? Maybe I'm still a little fuzzy on this. You talk about an unorthodox church. Were they baptized there, or where were they baptized?
Okay. I'll be more specific. This is like my case. Okay. You're familiar with the Worldwide Church of God, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, good.
Herbert
anyway,
Armstrong.
The story goes that
I used to read their magazines. Yep.
Yeah, me too. I'm not. Mm-hmm. Okay, here it is, Patrick. Okay, so the situation is that, okay, I was attending the church, but, you know, I used to go to the Catholic Church, but I never thought it was a Catholic. And then... then we get married in that church. But my wife was a Catholic. She was baptized and Catholic.
Okay.
But I didn't realize I was. So anyway, make a long story short, I start getting interested in the Catholic Church. So I go to RCA, whatever, make a long story short, I become a Catholic. But by then, we already have children. They're big mm-hmm. now, whatever. The whole thing. And then I realized one day I found my, I did get baptized in that church, Worldwide Church of God.
So, but you had already been baptized as a Catholic, as an infant?
I discovered it one time. I found my baptism because RCA says, we need a valid baptism. I said, I can't find it, but I'll give you the church, the Worldwide Church of God. And they accepted it. They said, okay, we'll accept it. Anyway, that's the story. So now, many years have gone by now. So do we live like brother and sister, right? That's my question.
Okay, that's clear to me now. I'm glad you clarified it. So there are a few layers here we need to look at. Number one, the Worldwide Church of God, at least then, they denied the Trinity. So, and it was an explicit denial of the Trinity. Now, they changed, and there was a real overhaul of their belief system so that now they're much more in line with evangelical Protestantism by accepting the Trinity. But under Herbert Armstrong and his father, I forget what his name
Garner
was,
Ted.
But yeah, Garner Ted, that's right. This to me, it's moot. This is a moot point because you had already received your baptism validly as an infant in the Catholic Church. So that's your golden card right there. You've got a valid baptism. You can count on that. And what you received in the Worldwide Church of God was not authentic baptism. It was a gesture. It was a ceremony. But you weren't rebaptized, because nobody can be rebaptized once they're validly baptized. But even if, let's just say, Jim, that you didn't have that first baptism as a Catholic, that second attempt at baptism, I'm certain would be, if the person at the parish understood what was going on there, would be deemed invalid because of the explicit denial of the Trinity, in which case they couldn't do what the church does. And even if they used the formula and they used water, they would not be doing what the Catholic Church does by baptizing people because of the denial of the Trinity. So, but let's leave that off to the side, because that's not really in your case. So in your case, your question is, do you and your wife have to live as brother and sister, because you've kind of gone through all of this and now you're at the point where you realize, I want to be Catholic. I want to live my faith. I'm guessing you've come back to the practice of the faith. Did you go to confession yet, Jim?
Yeah, I did all of that. I've been practicing since 2018, but my wife goes to a Protestant church. She doesn't want nothing to do with the Catholic Church. Exactly, I have.
Okay. So here's what you need. What you need to do is to sit down with the parish priest and ask for a convalidation of your marriage. And that is something, it involves a little bit of paperwork. And then the fundamental thing is you and your wife would publicly re-exchange consent. So your marriage consent to each other publicly made in the presence of the priest, or it could be a deacon or the bishop. That would be sufficient for your marriage to be convalidated. And she doesn't have to become Catholic for that to happen. She doesn't have to say, I like the Catholic Church. She can... It's sad and unfortunate that she has the view she does, but that's not necessary for your marriage to be convalidated. It can be, and it would be very simple. So knowing what you know, and because of this issue of invalidity, because you weren't married in the Catholic Church, and now you're discovering all these things. Hey, I was actually really Catholic. I didn't know that. You weren't at fault because you didn't know better and do the wrong thing. You just didn't know. And once you became aware of it, and you had your conversion experience, now you're trying to do the right thing. And the Lord knows that. And I'm sure he's pleased by the fact that you want to do things the right way. So to answer your question specifically, I would, if I were you, live as brother and sister until your marriage is convalidated. But that could be done today. That could be done this weekend. That could be done very quickly. It doesn't require a long time of preparation. The priest just has to make the arrangement, and then you express your consent publicly, your marriage is blessed, as they say colloquially, and you're good to go. And then you don't have to live as brother and sister.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay. So get in touch with a good Catholic priest, and if you're, I mean, probably at the parish that you attend, you know the priest there, I'm guessing, so you could, you know, you could talk with them. If you meet with any resistance or if you meet with apathy, hopefully that won't happen, get in touch with the Carmelite Sisters of the Most Sacred Heart of Los Angeles. Their mother house is in Alhambra. So if you're in LA, they're really close to you. And if you were to pop over there and visit with them and ask them if they have any recommendations for priests in the area that would be, you know, the kind of priests who would likely say, sure, I'll be happy to help you with that. And I think most priests would. I don't mean to suggest otherwise, but if you have difficulty for some reason, the Carmelite Sisters in Alhambra, they can help. Okay?
Okay, great. And is there a resource you can refer me to that? Because sometimes people ask me, where is that in the Bible? And let's say my wife gives me pushback and she refuses, then I would assume I'll have to live like brother and sister, but I don't want to cause scandal. You know what I mean?
I understand completely. Well, you're doing the right thing. I admire that. I don't have time to get into that. That's a whole separate field. I would recommend a book by Edward Peters called Annulments in the Catholic Church. That's a good book, and it's not biblical so much as it is what does the church ask, but start there, Jim. Thanks.
Okay.
Our sponsor, Christendom College, offers our listeners access to free online classes at getprinciples.com/truth. Acclaimed philosopher Dr. John Cuddeback is teaching a class now, Understanding Human Nature, at getprinciples.com/truth.
It's the Patrick Madrid Show. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that's right. Patrick Madrid Show every day, Monday through Friday, live, wherever you happen to be. And if you happen to be somewhere where we don't have a station yet, we're up to about 206 stations around the country, including our affiliates. And as I always say, shout out to all of our beloved affiliates. We sure appreciate you airing Relevant Radio. But all told, we're up to about 206 stations, and we're looking at some big expansion, God willing, anyway. But even if you're not in a place where we have Relevant Radio stations, you can still listen anywhere on planet Earth using the Relevant Radio app. So if you've got friends and family back in the old country, maybe in the Philippines or Italy or wherever you're from, tell them about Relevant Radio. Let them listen to Relevant Radio on the app. It's free. It's in the App Store. Let's go to Carrie now in Champion, Wisconsin. Boy, what a blessing for you, Carrie, to live right near the shrine of Our Lady of Champion. That's cool.
Yeah, right in our backyard.
Literally, yeah. Well, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I was just calling in for the woman who was adopting the two children, and one of them has a learning disability.
The ones who are adopting children from Colombia?
Yes, both of them.
Okay, right.
I just wanted to give her some words of encouragement and hope. We've got a wonderful Catholic school here that we send our children to, and our son has some mild learning disabilities, and the school has been wonderful in getting outside help with tutors coming in and state help coming in, sitting with him, helping him. Mm-hmm. You know, some advice for her is just to talk to the school that they plan on, you know, wanting to send their children to and seeing what kind of help they can offer or bring in. You know, it is possible.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That lady who's adopting the children from Colombia, she was choosing between homeschooling, Catholic school, or the local public school. And mm-hmm. I think that what you're saying is pretty common in my experience, that there are resources certainly available, and that most Catholic mm-hmm. dioceses have those very resources available as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we just talked with the school, and they've been so accommodating with helping
That's
our son.
Well, I'm really happy to hear that. God bless you and your family. So how far away are you? I mean, without giving your exact, location, are you a mile away from the shrine? Are you walking distance to the shrine?
Definitely walking distance.
That's great. Well, I'm happy for you, Carrie. And what was it like to have all the people? There were thousands of people again this past year for the Walk to Mary. That must have been exciting.
It was absolutely wonderful to see. It melts my heart to see so many people coming together. It's so amazing. I was a part of it. I only made 12 and a half miles, but this was my first year being a part of it. Yeah.
Did you have blisters on your feet when you were all done with the 12 miles?
You know, it's not so much my feet, it was my ankles.
Blisters on your ankles? Did you have high tops?
Okay. No, but apparently I wasn't wearing the right socks. Next year will be different.
Yeah, Father Rocky is an expert. And Cyrus, what's his mantra about that? Change your socks every X miles?
Every 7 miles. Change your socks every 7 miles.
Definitely will remember that one for next year.
All right, Carrie. Well, thanks for the call. Appreciate the info. Let's go to Fred now in Brooklyn. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Patrick. I have a question about the consecration. I noticed that there's one priest who he picks up the host and he extends both arms toward the people. Slightly moves to left and right, you know, and he gave the Eucharist and to us. He adds the words and to us. And then he doesn't consecrate. He consecrates, but he doesn't elevate, you know, the elevation.
Yeah, I go back to the first part. I'm not really clear what you mean. You said he puts his arms out, but what does he say and when does he say?
He has the Eucharist. He has the host in one hand, okay? Let's say it's its right hand. And then... He
he kind of extends it towards the people, towards the congregation. And his other hand is there, too. He's not touching the Eucharist.
All right, I get it now.
With the other.
I get it.
And then I noticed that the prayer, the consecration words do not say, and to us. He gave the bread. And he adds that, and to us. Is this right? Is this...
Does he say the words of consecration, though? This is my body.
Yes, he does.
Okay.
But before
I can
that,
answer your question. I can answer it. Okay, as for the let's just say, non-traditional holding the host with one hand only, that is, I don't think holding the host with both hands is the custom. And it's a time-honored custom. I don't know whether it is mandated in the rubrics of the Mass that the priest must hold the host with both hands. I tend to think it's probably not. And so this would be an eccentricity, perhaps. It suggests a kind of more casual approach to the Eucharist. You're just holding it in one hand instead of, you know, holding it with both hands. It would seem that holding it in both hands would suggest more reverence, but whatever. But I'm pretty confident that holding it in both hands or one hand is not something that the rubrics mandate. But the tradition is so common and so persistent that to not do that makes me, you know, I think it's reasonable to say, well, why aren't you doing that? Okay, that's one thing. Adding the "for us" is illicit because the rubrics of the Mass specify exactly what the priest is to say in the sacramentary, which is that liturgical book that's up on the altar that the priest is reading from. And any words that do not appear there should not be said. So that would be an issue of laicity, which has to do with, is it lawful for a priest to do or not do something that's prescribed? And then the other one, you mentioned that he does not elevate the host. Okay, none of these things are in any way touch upon the validity of the Holy Eucharist.
I understand that.
Okay, so
what gets me is he's holding it with one hand. Why is he extending his other hand out there? For what reason?
It sounds like it's just an eccentricity,
you know,
on his part.
You know, the Novus Ordo, it seems like every priest has his own rubrics. I've seen a priest break the host in midair over his head, not even concerned about the precious particles that might fall.
Yeah, these are things that are governed by the rubrics, Fred. And in the new rite of the Mass, the rubrics are very specific, what the priest should do. When you have priests who don't do that, shame on them. And God, they're going to have to answer to God for that. So that's what I can tell you. If you're asking if these things are illicit or not illicit, that's what I can tell you. Now, one final thing. The liturgical history of the elevation of the host, as near as I can tell from my researches on this topic and looking at the experts on the development of the Roman Rite, show pretty conclusively, I think, that the practice of the priest elevating the host only goes back to about the 11th or the 12th century. And prior to that, and that was in Paris, it seems, where it began. And it may have been practiced elsewhere before that, but it was certainly not the custom. And the reason for it in the first place, Fred, was so that the people would know that they can now adore Jesus in the Holy Eucharist, because prior to that, to the point of consecration, that was just a piece of bread. So that would be idolatry. So this is another reason, while I'm at it, for the bells. The bells were used by the altar servers to alert the people what was taking place on the altar, because the people and the priest are facing God in the same direction. And so they couldn't see what the priest was doing. And at a low Mass, he would be speaking in a low voice anyway, and they wouldn't hear it anyway. So the bells and the elevation of the host were the ways so that they could know, okay, now Jesus is present on the altar. And the reason I'm saying that, Fred, just so you know, is that prior to, let's say, the 11th or 12th century, when no priests elevated the host, it was no less of a Mass, it was no less holy, it was no less beautiful than once the practice of elevating the host began. I think it's a good thing that it began. But in itself, it doesn't change one way or the other the validity of the Mass. Now, you already know that, but I don't think it even would be a violation of the rubrics. It's not necessary that the priest elevate the host up to a certain height. It's the custom. I'll leave it at that. But thank you, Fred. I appreciate the interesting question. Let's go now to Rose in Chicago. Hi, Rose.
Hello, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Patrick, I have a godson that's getting married, and he's been living with this young lady for about 3 years. And they're going to get married in a non-denominational church. And he's a baptized Catholic, but don't no longer practices.
Okay.
So I did write him a letter, and I told him, you know, that I've always been proud of him, and that he's adding another chapter to his life, and mm-hmm. I want to help him get the dispensation. And okay. It's been about 3 weeks. I haven't heard back from him, and I don't know. I hope I do. I'm still praying about it, but I may not. But I did get an invitation to the shower for the girl. Okay. And I know I won't be able to go to the wedding because the ceremony is going to be at the reception with one of the yeah. non-denominational ministers. So do I go to the shower? Because they're honoring, yeah. you know, the young lady there.
Yeah, it's a tricky question because it's not, there is no validity or invalidity of a marriage or of a bridal shower. Mm-hmm. It's just a party. And it's a way mm-hmm. to, you know, and there has been no wedding yet. So I think one could safely say that you wouldn't be doing anything sinful if you were to go. It would extend into the question of would you still be causing scandal by giving the appearance of condoning what they are about to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that to me seems like it could go either way. And it would depend upon how much you want to emphasize that they shouldn't not do what the church asks them to do when they get married. By the way, so I would say if it were me, I probably wouldn't go. But if you did go, I don't think you would be committing any kind of a sin. Maybe if you can, check with the pastor. Well, maybe not. I was going to say, see if he could find out from the bishop. Thanks, Rose. I'll be right back with Hour 3 right after this.